There seem to be a lot of things that ought to be said, but I'm not going to say them. In the sense that we really have covered an extremely small gamut of possible discussions of social theory. Have concentrated attention, obviously, on various abstract levels, which in a sense I'm afraid I'm going to continue, but with for a few moments. Anyhow, but just to raise one or two points, I think, that that strike me forcibly as somebody who's interested in problems to do with change in the third world at the moment, which is very much more rapid, I think, changes that are going on of a structural empirical character, however one wants to describe these, than have been going, have happened elsewhere, and it's really one of the dominant phenomena of our present world, obviously, is the extreme rapid nature of social change that is going on there. And if one looks at that kind of situation, one is forced very much to differentiate social change in a whole variety of ways, which I'm not going to do now, in terms of cyclical changes and non-cyclical changes, of changes which are related to other aspects of the social system in the kind of functional way that Ernest Gell has mentioned, to others, and I tried to discriminate these in a very minor way publication I did on different inheritance systems, and one that seemed to me to be autonomous, to be unrelated to other aspects of the social system. I think we really haven't given much attention to that. We can disguise these, I think, or we can say, and it seems to me a legitimate argument from one point of view, to say that the kind of variations of, for example, a myth that I happen to be analysing at the moment are all, you know, different versions of the same myth. But I think that leaves open to me, anyhow, a great number of questions. I think they're the ones that Morris and Bedland touched upon now, of the whole problem of the generative aspects of social relationships, and the fact that in all social relationships people are acting in generative ways, and I believe this to be true even of societies that are relatively stable in inverted commas. Obviously it's a variable, but I do believe it to be true of relatively stable societies. And so there really are a whole lot of different phenomena, I think, which one is discussing under the rubric of social change. And it therefore is no surprise to me that there can be, in my view, no such thing as a theory of social change. I mean, I think it is a level of abstraction that dealing with social phenomena that one cannot have one theory. I mean, I can't imagine what it would look like even if we had it there. So that when one is talking about social change, one is talking about very different kinds of organizational change, structural change, so forth. One was dealing with the relative autonomy of different aspects of the social system. And one is also, of course, dealing with levels of the theory, levels of the model there, in the way that Tom Bottomore and Keith Hopkins have been discussing. And I think that my own view is that unless one brings it down to some kind of level of the kind that Keith Hopkins is discussing, that that one is really going to get very little change out of the situation. I mean, change in the other sense of the change in the other sense of the word. To think that 7 pages on 200 years of Roman history is a sort of empiricist discussion seems to me like claiming that Marx's analysis of 150 years of capitalism is an empiricist discussion of capitalism, and it's high-level abstraction. there, dealing with important variables and keeping at the center of consideration, and I say at the center and not at the top or the bottom deliberately, aspects of the reproduction of material life and the mode of production, which is what I understand by the one aspect, one valuable aspect of the crystallization of Marxist theory, but I really don't want to get into discussion of Marxist theory since we've been going around that for some time. Except on this level, on this aspect of the levels of the model here, I really again wonder you know, how much profit there is discussing the problem of the domination of institutional categories, just in the sense reverting to Tom Bottomore's point, because although in teaching social anthropology, we teach papers in politics, economics, kinships, and religion in that way, and have a separate paper on this, it has always seemed to me that these were notional distinctions, and I can't see them hardening. I mean, I see them hardening in a sense in 19th, 20th century European societies. I don't see them as institutional, as formally institutionally separate in societies that I have myself worked in. It isn't simply that kinship. It isn't simply that kinship is dominant. Is that it is impossible to distinguish between kinship, say, and economic and political roles in certain societies. I mean, that it is, there is no point in distinguishing them from any analytic purpose whatsoever that I can, see. It is quite true that, those, if you like, undifferentiated institutions there are playing, of course, the part that Morris ascribes and marriage and filiation and so forth. They're also involved in the economy, as we would, in the reproduction of material life. But it isn't, one cannot talk in that sense, I think, in any sensible way about domination there. It just doesn't, it doesn't leave me with any feeling of analytic satisfaction if I try to do that. I can see perfectly well that at certain given historical moments that, as others have said, that it may be possible to do this, but it does seem to me that it has to be tied in with a given with given historical situation, and that is again why I cannot see that in terms of however one redefines dominant, that one can have a general theory in that sense which is going to be terribly terribly satisfactory. The other problem in aspects of the analysis of social change that I myself have since been involved with in contemporary situations is again the whole problem of which other people have discussed, which I don't see an easy way out of, which do involve a matter of judgment, of assessment, of weighting, even possibly of measurement in quotes by the analyzer at different points of time, and this is the assessment of change, of the nature of change, of actually giving some weighting to different elements in the model one is in. I mean, there's that aspect of model or theory building there, and there's the aspect that others have referred to of where to break into the of where to break into the circle. I mean, unless we break into the circle, we are, I think, in the sort of functionalist in the functionalist dilemma that many of us would like to get out of. The second general point, the others covered rather many, but the second general point I wanted to make was that if one looks at new nations particularly, one is really concerned, of course, with internal changes, but one is concerned very much more with exogenous factors in the situation. I mean, the first industrial nation has particular problems of its own in being the first industrial nation, and every other nation after that is not the first industrial nation, they are no longer the first industrial nation, by definition. So that immediately, and directly this happens to agricultural societies or any level of change like that, one is a situation in the world in which one has to deal not simply, of course, with unilateral systems which help you break out, but with what various people have called the articulation of modes of production, the contact between systems in very real senses. And nobody conceivably has worked in the third world without having very forcibly to realize that this aspect of the relationship, the articulation, if you want, or the conflict, I mean, both between different, if I may call them, systems of social relationship rather than societies or cultures, in order to get out of Edmund's situation there, I mean, really is a fundamental problem in social change for anyone who is looking at that. And the third point I want to mention is that I think that in some discussions there, this has happened, for example, in Parsons' discussions of social change insofar as he has one, but I think it is also true of other structural function analysis, and I use this in a wide sense to include many linguistic analyses, is that to some extent the problem of social change gets confused may not be quite the right word here, with the problem of transformations. People tend to try and deal. I mean, Parsons actually makes this equivalent at one particular time. One is not dealing with the same problem there. The problem of transformations has its own value, especially in exploring a set of limited possibilities. But there is great danger, I think, in allowing the notion of transformation to be seen as a substitute for the analysis of social change and the assessment of the particular sets of relationship that lead to, if you like the choice, I use the word in a rather deliberate, in a very simple-minded way, between sets of alternatives under particular situations. In order to make some assessment of the kinds of changes, of the situations under which A change is to be, however one wants to find A and B, then we need to analyze, firstly, the possibilities of variations in social formations. Secondly, we need to do these in the light of a range of productive, though I would give productive a central significance here, and other variables that are associated with shifts from one possibility to another. Thirdly, we need to take account at the same time of relevant long-term directional factors which are involved in social change. And I think that it is here, I think, that social anthropology or asocial anthropology, which is one at once deeply empirical in one sense and is also theoretical in a comparative sense, whatever sort of comparison one is adopting, I think approaches the academic field of history, but works at a different level of analysis, and can make, I think, its own contribution to the analysis of social change in the kind of way I think that Keith Hopkins did so admirably. So admirably this morning, that in a sense gives one a framework for discussing variables in the situation of servitude or slavery or dependent labour. I mean, I agree absolutely with Edmund's problem about, you know, the definition of slavery here. It seems to me that one can, without going into the legal factors of legal definition there, see and define similarities of process in the production and the reproduction of servile labour, which do crop up in different parts of the world. But I can ask questions as to what difference it makes when you bring in tribal groups in the way that Ernest and Edmund were talking about there, or when you do more deliberately go out raiding on annual raiding systems, or you get the Thracians or the Scythians to do it for you, and pull in and pull in individuals as individuals in that way, who are depersonalized in that way. Because obviously, to take one of these points that he made about the functions of slavery in the Roman system, that the long distance mobility is achieved in one case, but obviously not so easily in the other case. I mean, he's stripping them down like that. I mean, he gets this business, he can move them about and shift them about like pawns in that way, like pawns in a game of chess in that way, and move them about there. Another aspect in that sense of the mobility of labor, a rather different sense from the geographical one that that Keith didn't mention in that context, but which has very much impressed me in Africa, and I think it would in other, in Jamaican slavery, certainly this is true, and that is that the slavery cross-cut completely the normal, in quotes, division of labor. That is to say, slaves performed female and male tasks. I mean, you see them, pictures of them carrying wood and so on in Africa and water, which no male would do, no free male would do under any circumstance. And of course, they were employed, again, on one of the arguments that Dunn and others have produced for the lower fertility of slave populations in the on Jamaican plantations, were that more women were employed directly in productive tasks there, and that they had a productive role to play in cutting sugarcane there, and therefore were presumably had a great number of more stillbirths or abortions under that situation there. So I think that one can, at that level, begin to look at problems to do with differences and social change. And when one gets down to that level of analysis, that I find very difficult to discuss at the higher one, just because it seems to me that one is dealing with such a wide range of social phenomena there, which are not really amenable to the kind of verbal intercourse in which we are engaging today. Thank you.